It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Eight Democratic presidential candidates will convene in Pittsburgh Saturday for a forum to discuss equity in education. Earlier this week, both President Trump and Vice President Pence campaigned in Pennsylvania. Joining us in studio are WESA's education reporter, Sarah Schneider. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kevin.
And Chris Potter, editor of WESA's government accountability team. Hello, Chris.
Good to be with you.
So, Chris, with all these candidates, Republicans and Democrats here, is this the first real skirmish in the battleground state of Pennsylvania?
Yeah, it's going to be like the French and Indian War. They're just going to sort of like wander the countryside taking pot shots at each other through the trees. But yeah, I mean, clearly what we're seeing here, just this concentration of visits, is Pennsylvania, as I think we all know, is a key bellwether state, a swing state, deemed just absolutely essential for Donald Trump to win re-election next year.
And we've had individual candidates come to the Pittsburgh area, come to Pennsylvania, but this is the most at any one time.
Yeah, I think this is the most Democrats that have ever been, Democratic candidates that have ever been in Pittsburgh at the same time ever. I don't think there's ever, to my recollection at least, there hasn't been a moment like this any time in my lifetime.
On the morning the Democrats presented the articles of impeachment against President Trump, Vice President Pence was in Beaver County. What was the atmosphere? What was his message?
I wasn't there. Of course, it was my colleague Ariel Worthy who was. But this was an event arranged by Veterans for Trump, which is just what it sounds like, a national group of veterans who support Trump. And, you know, the message was Donald Trump has your back. We're making reforms at the long-troubled VA. We're spending all kinds of money on defense and weapon systems so you never go hungry for a bullet again. And that is the kind of message that they're offering. Mr. Pence has been here repeatedly, and that, too, shows the significance of this state and this area.
Is Beaver County Trump country? Why did he visit Beaver County?
Yeah, it's exactly. I think Beaver went close to 60%, something like that, for Trump in 2016. I'm kind of going off my recollection here. But it's not just Beaver. It's places like Beaver. You're going to see Mr. Pence and Mr. Trump in a lot of these counties, as we did in 2016, go into those places that are kind of off the beaten path for Democrats because that's where his votes are, as opposed to Pittsburgh itself or Philadelphia or the counties outside of it.
And it was Vice President Pence's, I believe, fourth visit already to Pennsylvania this year. Later on Tuesday, Pence met up with the president for a rally in Hershey. From what our colleague Katie Meyer reported, it seemed like these were hardcore Trump supporters saying, for example, not one thing could change their minds. He's the best president in a long, long, long time. This was a strong support for the president.
Yeah, and that's been consistent throughout his presidency. The people who are with the president, I think he has something like 90% approval rating from Republicans. The people who are with him are unshakably with him. So I don't think it's any surprise to anybody who's read, you know, the New York Times goes to a diner and talks to some people in Erie or whatever. The people who were with him in 2016 are just as much, if not more, with him now, in part because there's this sort of persecution narrative now. These Democrats, they won't accept the result, and we have to put a stop to that, even if we have a little bit of ambiguity about Donald Trump in the back of our minds.
So should we expect future visits by Mr. Pence or Mr. Trump to be in similar places, suburban, rural counties, rather than, say, Philly or Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I would expect a sort of reprise. I mean, I'm obviously not being brought into the confidences of the Trump administration, but I'd expect a reprise of their strategy in 2016. They're going to go to places like Johnstown and Erie and those places that are big cities in their rural counties, but obviously not the Pittsburghs and the Philadelphias. There's just not a lot here for them.
It worked for them.
And it worked. 16. Yeah, you can't argue with the results.
It's The Confluence. We're talking about the presidential campaign coming to Pennsylvania this week and an education forum scheduled to be held in Pittsburgh this Saturday. Sarah Schneider, what's the reason for this education forum on Saturday featuring Democratic presidential candidates?
Well, I would say the main reason, you know, we've got 11 groups supporting this forum. They're organizing it, brought it to Pittsburgh. They really want education to be a key factor in this election. And I think many would argue that it's not. It hasn't been so far in the when hearing from Democratic candidates. So the reason it's in Pittsburgh is because these local groups really fought for it to be here. We've got, you know, activist group One Pennsylvania. It's a statewide initiative, but they've got local presence here in Pittsburgh. And they fought very hard to get this here, as well as the, you know, Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers. It's the Teachers Union for Pittsburgh Public Schools. But it is spearheaded by two national teachers unions,
the NEA
and the American Federation of Teachers.
So a lot of teachers and their representative supporters will be present?
Yeah. We think about 1,000 people will be there. And the format is going to be, you know, each candidate will be up on stage. They're going to get like 20 to 30 minutes, and they're going to answer questions from a teacher, a parent, a student, and then the moderators. MSNBC will be moderating.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a key thing politically as well. The AFT alone has more than 1.5 million members nationwide. The NEA, I think, is even larger than that. Teachers are a critical constituency within the Democratic Party, and folks may remember in 2016, the union got behind, the AFT got behind Hillary Clinton real early in the process. And there was some concern about that because there were some teachers who were supportive of Bernie Sanders. So you got a lot of candidates here trying to break out of what's been sort of an amorphous field. And educators are key to that. Public school teachers are just huge. If you can line these folks up and get them behind you, it's really a way to make a difference throughout the primary.
Which candidates do we expect to take part?
Okay, we've got a list. We've got 8, as you had mentioned. So former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, U.S. Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, and Michael Bennett. And then, you know, Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, and then businessman Tom Steyer.
Was it an open invitation to all candidates, or did they have to demonstrate a certain level of support, as they have to do to get on stage for the organized debates?
They let Bennett in, so I guess anybody could make it.
From what I understand, you know, the candidates who qualified for the October debate were invited to attend, and more could, you know, confirm by Saturday. We'll see.
The event is at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. Doesn't seem to be for the general public, but more so for the groups that have organized this event?
Yeah, it's invitation only. So members of the organizing groups, so teachers were invited, but teachers from across the country. So 1,000 people we expect to be in attendance. A lot of those people will be asking questions. You know, we've got 8 candidates, and so 8 teachers will be questioning.
So whether it's in the debates to this point, or campaign stops by individual candidates, have any of the candidates actually focused much on education as a top issue in the 2020 elections?
I would say no.
The big issue, I would say, education has to do with higher education and paying it, because there's some strong distinctions between where the candidates are at. You've got a couple of the more progressive candidates who are talking about free college education. On the other end of that spectrum, you got somebody like Amy Klobuchar, who basically derides that as, you know, paying for the rich kids to go to Harvard or whatever. On the public school, there hasn't been so much, in part because there's less diversity of opinion, although there's a little bit. Cory Booker, I think just a couple weeks ago, had an op-ed in the New York Times. He's been a supporter of charter schools when he was the mayor of Newark, still kind of supports that cause. So I think you'll see some tension there, which will I think really come to the fore. But generally speaking, they have different emphasis and stuff like that, but they're pretty committed to public education. They hate Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump's education secretary. So I don't think you see quite the same points of distinction that you do with some of the other issues out there.
Sarah, have they truly defined what they mean by equity in education?
For this forum? And
yes.
Yeah. So the top issues are going to be discipline is a huge issue when it comes to equity. The school-to-prison pipeline is this term that refers to the disproportionate amount of students who, black and brown students, who are suspended from school. That's something that the teachers union really cares about. They've talked about a lot. So that will come up a lot. Also, when we talk about equity, the teaching staff in general is not diverse. It's a majority white women. And some candidates have mentioned that. Pete Buttigieg, especially, you know, in his education plan he released like 2 weeks ago, that was mentioned. But I think what voters will be interested to hear is how much these candidates know about education, because they really set the tone at a federal level, especially with funding. But a lot of it is local.
That's what I was going to say. A lot of these issues tend to be developed and responded to, whether it's at the state level or specifically at the district level, whether it's discipline or equity, as you would say.
Yeah. But, you know, so Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, has rolled back a lot of guidance from the Obama administration, you know, guidance on discipline, on use of bathrooms and some other things that it's not just setting the tone. It was guidance that schools were using, they were taking up, and then that was rolled back in the past 2 years.
There's also been talk about sort of funding for schools with high levels of poverty, things like that, and so that's a big deal as well. Some of the candidates have talked about, I think Bernie Sanders has talked about, a sort of $60,000 mm-hmm. minimum salary for teachers, and I assume that you do that by attaching it to that funding. But you're right. I mean, to a large extent, if you're talking about standardized testing and some of the other things that are big issues amongst Democrats and teachers in particular, a lot of that stuff is set at the state and local level.
What do you each expect from Saturday's forum? A lot of agreement, head nodding, or do you think there'll be some points of contention?
I think there will be a lot of agreement. Probably the biggest point of contention right now is charter policy. You know, many of the candidates, the top candidates, Biden, Warren, have said that they would not support federal funding for charters run by for-profit organizations. Cory Booker is, you know, has been a strong proponent for charter expansion. So I think he'll have to answer for that, especially with a group that is pretty against charter expansion.
Chris?
Yeah, Cory Booker, I think, is kind of the one candidate here who feels like he's going into the lion's den. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of have to respect somebody who's bringing that message just as, again, a few weeks after he did an editorial in a national newspaper saying we need to, you know, we need. Now, I think he has some questions about for-profit charters and things like that. But, yeah, I think that will be the big issue. But, you know, to your point, I do think there's going to be a broad agreement on a lot of these issues when it comes to funding, when it comes to this current administration. So, yeah, will this have the same level of fireworks that maybe some other issues do? Maybe not. But it is, like, as I said before, you know, this is a critical demographic. And Sarah's right. I think people want to hear that, you know, their issues, that you can check their boxes and that they feel comfortable with somebody like you advocating for their jobs and for their industry.
And it's a chance for these education advocates to get the candidates to address issues that are of concern to them, or an issue that is concern to them.
Yeah, I think we'll also hear about teacher pay, especially as this is an event sponsored by teachers unions, and we'll hear a lot about school safety.
So back to President Trump and Vice President Pence. Have they said much, anything about education priorities at the national level? Chris, you mentioned, you talked about Education Secretary DeVos, but have any of these, has Mr. Trump or Mr. Pence talked education at all so far?
So President Trump has spoken largely at length about school safety. So he supports arming teachers, or, you know, teachers being able to carry a gun in school. He's also suggested, he's voiced a lot of support for choice, so more voucher programs and expansion of charters. We've seen that through his education secretary, Betsy DeVos.
Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's government accountability team. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Otis Redding was one of the most influential musicians of his time, though his time on this earth was far too short. The Georgia-born soul singer was on the verge of cracking widespread mainstream success when he lost his life, along with four members of his backing band, the Bar K's, in a plane crash this week in 1967. Redding had recorded his soon-to-be signature song just a few days earlier. Sitting on the Dock of the Bay was released a month later and swiftly climbed the charts, becoming the first ever posthumous number one single. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Allegheny County's Sewer Authority has a new agreement with the EPA to keep sewage out of the Three Rivers. But how green is the plan? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. During a press conference this fall, Arletta Scott Williams, the executive director of the Allegheny County Sanitary Authority, or ALCASAN, led the crowd in a chant.
I say green, you say green. Green.
Green.
Green.
Green.
Green. You don't mean it like I mean it, though.
She meant a new focus on green infrastructure, capturing rainwater with landscaping and plants. Williams announced the modified consent decree with the Environmental Protection Agency will cost about $2 billion and require compliance by 2036. Oliver Morrison of Public Source has a new story out about what's included in the plan.
One big part is they're going to expand their sewage treatment plant so that instead of just being able to treat about 250 million gallons a day, it expands to about 600 million gallons a day. The next part of the plan is to build three giant tunnels underneath the rivers so that when it rains, a lot of that water that runs off into the streets would be captured into those tunnels. And then when it was drier, they could treat that at the plant. And so all the sewage wouldn't pour out into the rivers.
That's called gray infrastructure. Pipes, it's things made out of cement. It's the stuff that's not growing or green. Is this going to be in addition to green infrastructure? What's the breakdown?
People have been wondering for a bunch of years, how much of this $2 billion is it going to actually end up in green infrastructure? And right now we have the best answer that we've been able to have so far. They've got this $100 million grow fund where they're supposed to spend it on green. And what we've seen so far is that they're spending about a third of the money that's been coming out of there has been going on green infrastructure. The remaining $1.9 billion, we also have a new answer because they have this new study out that suggests that only $29 million of that $1.9 billion is going to go potentially towards green infrastructure. Now, this is preliminary. They say they have more work to do. They can't confirm it, but this is their best guess so far.
When did that study come out?
It will be published in April, but they released the preliminary results in November.
I have a feeling that environmentalists have opinions about ALCASAN's new plan, and some of them are not favorable.
I would say that's true. There's been a long-running campaign to try and get ALCASAN to spend more money on green infrastructure in the region. This includes groups like the Sierra Club, Pittsburgh United, but also some neighborhood groups. They see this giant price tag, $2 billion, and they're thinking, this big chunk of money just doesn't come along very often, and so we're not going to get that many more opportunities for such a large sum of money to be spent on cleaning our waterways. And so they want to be able to do it in a way that maximizes the environmental impacts. And for them, that means more green infrastructure and less gray infrastructure. So even though they understand ALCASAN's arguments that they're focused on sewage, they think, hey, like, let's look at some other things as well.
So why isn't green infrastructure more feasible in more locations?
Well, green infrastructure can be really expensive depending on where you put it and how you make it. So you can't really build green infrastructure on railroads or on top of buildings very quickly. And so what ALCASAN did was they looked at when you put it in there, how much of this water could you remove? And what they found was that there were few places that you could remove enough water that it would be able to replace the pipes and do as good a job as the pipes at that same price or cheaper. And so ALCASAN looks at its authority very narrowly. We're a sewage authority. Our job is to take care of the sewage and do it at the cheapest possible price for our ratepayers, and that's what we do. And because of that narrow focus, they don't see a lot of opportunities for them investing in green infrastructure.
You can find Oliver Morrison's full story at publicsource.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Memorial services were held over the weekend to mark the 10th anniversary of the death of Penn Hills police officer Michael Crawshaw, who was fatally shot in the line of duty. He was ambushed in his patrol car by a suspect who had just killed another man over a drug debt. Officer Crawshaw's mother, Linda Crawshaw, is on the line. Linda, thanks for joining us.
Certainly.
Linda, Michael was a Penn Hills officer for about 2.5 years, and prior to that, a University of Pittsburgh police officer. When he first told you he wanted to be a police officer, what was your reaction?
Definitely surprised. His younger brother, Matthew, was already a police officer working in Richland Township. Just never heard Mike before. Ever speak about being a police officer, although he did work as a probation officer for Allegheny County And he just came home one day and said, I think I'm going to the police academy.
Were you proud? Were you concerned? Fearful?
Well, yeah. Yes, very proud that, you know, Mike always was a very kind and helpful person, and so it wasn't that surprising that he would want to do whatever he could to help others. But I was also very concerned. The thought of having two sons, both out being police officers, was led to many sleepless nights.
Right. Is Michael's brother still a police officer?
Yes, he is. Mm-hmm.
Has your concern grown for him after Michael's death?
Yeah, of course. I think once you realize that this can happen anywhere to anyone, especially when Matthew worked up until about 6 months ago, he had worked steady night turn. So there were all those nights when you woke up at night and, you know, had to think he was out there. And that concern, you know, kept me awake many nights, I can tell you that.
At Michael's funeral, as is the tradition, there were officers from all around the country. But then everyone else gets to keep living their lives. Maybe they're crushed in the moment, but unless they were very, very close to the person, the most acute of those feelings sometimes fade. How are you doing 10 years later?
Well, it's difficult. It's you know, on any given day, you have these waves of emotion. It's not like you go ever one day without thinking about Mike. And just some days are worse than others. And anniversaries and birthdays and holidays are all particularly difficult. I've had the support of Sue Sciullo throughout this whole journey that we've been on. As you know, Paul Sciullo, her son, was killed 8 months prior to Mike.
Yes, he was one of three Pittsburgh police officers.
Yes.
Eric Kelly, Stephen Maley, and Paul.
Correct.
They were killed also in an ambush in Stanton Heights.
Yes, and we've gotten to be very close friends, and now if we aren't calling one another, we're texting one another or emailing one another. When one's having a bad day, we lean on each other.
So over the weekend, there was the memorial service at Penn Hills Municipal Building and then a memorial mass at St. Sebastian Church.
There was also a memorial in Shaler, where we're from.
So what did all those services mean to you?
Well, I think it's just very, very heartwarming that after 10 years, people still come out to remember Mike at these memorials, and it's a testament to the person, the special person that Mike was.
Linda Crawshaw is the mother of Penn Hills police officer Michael Crawshaw, who was killed in the line of duty 10 years ago, December 6, 2009. Linda, thank you so much for sharing your memories and your story.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, it's coming up on 2 years since medical marijuana has been available in Pennsylvania. What role will research on the effectiveness of the medication have on possible expansion of the program? Plus, advocates want the Commonwealth to take the next step, legalizing recreational marijuana. It's an hour-long Confluence special on the future of marijuana in Pennsylvania. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Joe Yazenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.